Well, once again, hello to everybody and those of you who are with us on the webcast as well. We're always happy to have anywhere from seems about a dozen to two dozen or so each week that log in for the webcast. We're happy to have you with us on this particular Sabbath day. Quick update with our family. We are making progress with getting our house in order. We killed a dogwood this week. We severely injured a big maple tree, and we slaughtered the rhododendrons. Well, two survived, but the rest of them decimated, cut off below the ground. The folks, I think, that owned our house before, they lived in Florida, but they only spent about half the year here for the past 4 or 5 years, and everything was significantly overgrown. But Linda's from a logging family. So her father was a logger, her brother was a logger, so we logged. And it's starting to look great. We're looking forward before long to be able to have some of you over. And Amanda had some friends that you may have met, the girls from Cincinnati who were here the other weekend. And one of them who has known us a long time, she and Amanda have known each other since they were 10, she said, "This is the first time I've ever been in your house when everything wasn't exactly where it's supposed to be." It's because it was in boxes, and you know, we're still in the midst of unpacking. But we're getting settled in, and we're really pleased, enjoying the neighborhood in Massillon. It's working out quite nicely, I think. Okay, I hope I haven't given this message here, but if I have, then just smile sweetly and listen anyway. I gave it in Wheeling, and I gave it in Pittsburgh, and now and then I lose track of where I gave what. So if I see eyes roll when we wade into this, then I may just, you know, we can divert and go in different directions or add something that you don't know about. But how many of you know much about the Bible geography anyway? Especially when we're talking about historical Bible geography. Bible geography right now, and I have maps. We're unpacking the boxes, and I teach Bible geography at ABC, in addition to the writings class, which covers a whole host of books in the Bible. But geography, we didn't have a geography class 4 years ago, and so I suggested to Mr. Antion that we start one because it's instrumental in understanding where things are and have a sense of place. When you're reading the Bible and you read about this place and then you read about that place, and you're like, I don't know where any of that is. And I know that the Bronx is in New York, but I never heard of this place. I think it's in New York. To have some knowledge of the topography is important. So I have collected Bible atlases. I had a couple. Now we have a flock of them. And it's fun to pick them up and you look at them. Every atlas, you know, whoever selected the maps or drew the maps will add a certain personal emphasis. And that gives you a broader picture and perspective of where things are. But where things are when is even more interesting. What were things like when Christ was there? What was it like when David was king? Well, that goes back to 1000 B.C. Christ goes back to the beginning of this era. You know, the first century A.D., Anno Domini, the year of our Lord. That's what Anno Domini means in Latin. And they were off by 4 years. Did you know that? The A.D. era, Christ was not born in the year zero, because number one, there's no year zero. There is a year zero, but he wasn't born then. He was born, by best reckoning, either 3 or 4 B.C. Most think 4 B.C. And you think, well, how could you be born 4 years before Christ when you're Christ? Well, when we were at the big dig in Jerusalem, in 1973, we worked in holes. We had twine, and they put it on stakes, and they made these rectangles. We were up against the face of a cliff. So at the base of that cliff, we were working. Four groups of ambassador students. There were about 8 of us in each one of these holes. It wasn't a hole when we started, but by the third day, it was a hole. And then it just got deeper till we hit bedrock, and then they had to move us to another spot. But One day, the team next to us had, been busy digging and digging. We're always finding bits of pottery, occasionally something interesting, a Herodian lamp. These would be lamps from the time of Christ or time of Herod. And I don't know if you have a Brown Betty teapot in your house, classic teapot with a little teaspoon, little spout off to the side. If you got a Brown Betty teapot like that just before it was fired in the furnace and you just smooshed it straight down and threw the lid away, that would be an oil lamp. That would have been in place of a candle. You would have poured oil, olive oil typically, into the area where the teapot would have, the tea would have steeped, and except these would be miniatures. And then there's a little spout that comes out the end. You'd stick a wick into that spout that reaches into the oil. You'd light the wick. And that was a candle. So the golden candlesticks of Revelation 2 and 3 that you find in the King James Bible weren't candlesticks at all in our normal thinking of wax with a wick going up to the wax. It was a candle stand, and those lamps. It was a lampstand, technically. A lampstand with those little lamps on each one of the little platforms that are up on the arms of the lampstand. So that was, we found a number of the Herodian lamps. But one day the next hole next to us had all gotten out and they'd gone to get water, because at a certain point we had to have water breaks. It was 105 degrees and we're working, digging and moving a lot of soil and sifting through things. And, so one of the other fellows in my group decided, let's pull a prank on them. So we had picked up a piece of junk pottery. I walked to work. Everybody else rode the bus, but I liked to walk. It was 2 miles or 2.5 miles cross country around the edge of Jerusalem to get to the dig. And I picked the pottery up. It was just a flower pot. But if you took some rough gravel and you rubbed it really good, we antiqued it first. And then we got a nail. Someplace we found a nail and we scratched a date on it. 4 BC. And then as soon as they left their hole, we dived over the top and found a spot where they were going to dig next. And we put it down under about an inch of sand. And sure enough, they found it. And they were so excited and they were all cheering and yelling and calling for our dig boss to come and see what they'd found. It took them probably 5, 6, 7 minutes. And it dawned on them they'd been had. Which was good. Mike Ben Eliezer, the Hebrew University professor who was a dig boss, he had not been summoned. They hadn't found him, so they were able to save face while we were all rolling in the dirt laughing next door. So, a bit of fun with Bible geography and Bible history. When you study geography, you're going to look at a number of things. Topography, the lay of the land, the hills, the valleys, all that sort of thing. Natural resources. What precious minerals are in the soil? We've got gas and oil in Ohio, and we've had coal in Ohio, and probably lots of other things, but Ohio has a lot of gas and oil and coal. Timber, Ohio used to be covered with it, and it is increasingly covered with more of it as time has gone by, which has really helped the ecosystem here to rebuild a lot. Wildlife, fish, people have to live to eat things. Soil, seashores, now those are natural resources. We look at populations when you study geography. Where do the people live? That will help you to understand the land and the lives of those who live on the land. Language cultures. In America we have only one language they say, but even up until the recent spate of massive immigration over the past 10 years, we had 9 separate cultures in America, according to those who studied it. I couldn't catch the nuance on all 9 of them, but some of them you can. You got North and you've got South, you've got Scots-Irish culture, both North and South, which are similar, but they're not quite similar. They're a little bit different too. They're very distinctive, and you got Texas. It has a culture all to itself, big enough to do that. And so on and so forth. So you're going to look at the language cultures. If it's a land that has actually different languages, then you get a language culture with that, that goes with that particular language. You look at agriculture. What's the climate like? What crops can be grown there? What are the soil fertility rates? You look at business and technology. which is going to include the biggest business of all for most countries is agriculture. People have to eat. And fishing and lumbering, mining, manufacturing, and trade. All of those things are going to be considered when you study geography. You'll look at education, what schools and universities. You're going to look at the impact of religion on the nation. Now, right now, we live in an age of secular priesthood. In other words, they don't believe in any religion. Except they do. It's theirs. And they're going to enforce their doctrines on this country. You know, we can expect that. But you look, that's important. You have to look and to understand the geography of a land, you're going to look at how the religions of that land affect it. In ancient Israel, you're certainly going to look at it, because when they were obedient to God, which was the true religion, and all other religions are not true, then things went fairly well with them. But when they left God, He disciplined them. Number one, they ran into the basic built-in penalties of broken law, of sin. But God also disciplined them because they were supposed to be His nation. So, again, religion was very important there. Was Israel be primarily pagan, or were they primarily worshiping the true God? You look at the military. Army, Navy, size of the forces, their weapons, technologies. In modern times and ancient times, you look at similar things. You know, did they use chariots, or did they have mounted cavalry? Were they using bronze or iron, because iron's harder than bronze, sort of thing? That's all a factor that's important, because the geography of one nation can be subsumed into the geography of a greater nation or an empire, because their weapons technology or deliverability, in using our fancy-dancy modern nuclear terms, wasn't as good as the other one. You look at strategic features. What are the coastlines? Are there harbors? Are there navigable rivers? What about river crossings? Mountains and passes and deserts? You look at all those things. America is the most amazing. Somebody was showing me a marvelous picture of a map the other day, and it showed the drainage of the Ohio and the Mississippi and the and all the rivers in the Mississippi drainage. When you look at what there was to America, it was built to prosper. Most countries don't have anywhere near the navigable river systems that we had. And so way before we had trains, we had boats, river boats, that could take things down to New Orleans, or part way, and then, you know, trade them there for something else. America was hugely blessed with the river systems that it has. Russia has a lot of rivers, too. Most of them flow into the Arctic Ocean. And so, how is that going to help? Well, it's good for skating. They're limited. Well, they have a few rivers, you know, that are. Europe has the Danube and the Rhine, a few rivers, but America is just massively blessed. The Missouri, Mississippi, that line of the river is 4,000 miles long. Starts in Montana. If you start for the headwaters of the Missouri, where the Madison, the Gallatin, and the Jefferson rivers all come together. There's a town there they call Three Rivers. I wonder why. And that is considered the beginning of the Missouri Mississippi drainage. Actually, you can go up the Gallatin and the Jefferson and the Madison, fly fishing as you go, because that's what they're really good for. You could still have used those with canoes and lighter weight craft, which would have increased it beyond the 4,000 miles. That's a long river drainage. The Ohio-Mississippi drainage is not as long, but it is coming out of a more densely populated area, and it very effectively drains that. So you look at that's strategic, that's important. River crossings. You got big rivers, how do you get across them? Ask the French. They will name any place that's a good crossing La Crosse, as that means the crossing. And guess, there's La Crosse, Wisconsin, crossing on the Mississippi. And there was La Crosse, Ohio. You didn't know that, did you? They changed it. It's called Cincinnati now. Cincinnati was La Crosse. Later, that was named after something else completely different, and that's another story for another time. But that's geography. You're also going to look, when you start looking at historical geography, it's all of those things put into a historical setting, a given time. What were things like at a particular time in the history of a nation? You're going to study then as well the effects of wars. You're going to study the effects of wise or foolish agricultural practices and forest management practices and business practices. You're going to study the effects of natural or divine disasters. Some disasters are natural. They just happen to happen. Other disasters have divine implications, because there are times when God has brought disasters. Take, for example, in the days of Hezekiah, this would be about 700 B.C., when the Assyrians had powered back up and they came back to take Judah. They had already taken the house of Israel. Now they came back to conquer the house of Judah. In fact, they did destroy about a number of the frontier towns and took about 200,000 captives, according to their own records, back to Assyria. But when they attacked Jerusalem, that was their death knell. Because Hezekiah was a righteous king, and when he realized that he was being besieged by the Assyrian army, he took the letter that the emperor had written and sent by his commander called the Rabshakeh, and he took his copy before God up by the temple, and he prayed and said, "Look at what these people are saying. Please intervene. Have mercy on us." And it's a great story, because they all woke up dead. In the King James, it sounds like it says that in the morning they awoke and behold, they were dead. 185,000 Assyrians wiped out in one night. So in that sense, they woke up dead. They didn't wake up at all. An entire expeditionary force. So what meager forces were left to the Assyrian emperor beat a hasty retreat northeast back home. And Judah was spared. For many decades, she was spared. So that was a divine disaster that was brought upon the Assyrians in that case. But you're going to study the effects of droughts and of famines, growing season changes, you know, freezes. We don't often think about that, but if we had, America could be in a serious, serious food shortage situation by having a late freeze and an early freeze. That's all it takes. Corn will die. If it froze, you know, tonight, all the corn growing would be dead. I mean, if it was a hard freeze, it'd kill it. That's it. Unless you had a bunch of snowfall on it first. It was on the 6th of June in 1967, I believe. We experienced that in South Dakota. Our corn was about that high, 7 or 8 inches. And we had 6 inches of snow one night, and it got down below freezing. And then the next morning, the sun came back out and melted the snow. Our corn did not die because it had snowpack around it. It insulated it. The areas of that farming community, there were a few areas where they didn't get as much snow, and then that corn died because it froze. But if we had a freeze too late or a freeze too early, we would be in serious straits. So if man thinks that he can get by and he can thumb his nose at God, he needs to think twice, which is what repentance means. Think again. Okay, so that's historical geography. So here's going to be our exercise for this sermon. And I think you're going to find it very interesting. What can we glean from the Scripture about the historical geography of the Promised Land? We're going to look at three different times. First of all, we'll look at the conquest time. This would be the end of the wandering, the 40 years of wandering, just when Moses has died and Joshua is leading the Israelites into the Promised Land. And we're actually looking at it as it was even 38 years earlier, when Moses sent the scouts into the land. Then we'll move forward about, that would have been in the neighborhood of around 1400 B.C. Then we move forward 400 years, and we'll look at it again, what it would have looked like at the time of King David. And then we'll go forward 1,000 years to the time of Christ. And then we'll look at a little bit of what's happened since to help us get it in perspective. If you go to the land of Israel now, Victoria was there when our family was there and some of the others. The last trip that ABC sponsored was a year ago this past spring. The Israelis have done wonders in reforestation, in developing irrigation systems, drip irrigation, so that they can grow crops where nobody else could. They've figured out how to do it. They're very effective at that. So it's remarkably green, but there are areas where it is still eroded, denuded, and barren, especially in the south and over toward the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea wasn't always like that, though. In fact, prior to Moses' time, and go back to the time of Abraham, remember the discussion that Abraham had with Lot? Their holdings, they had livestock, and they were traders, and they tended to camp on the trade routes. The livestock they had was too much to be on the land beside each other, and their herdsmen were getting on each other's nerves. And so Abraham, being the older, said to his nephew Lot, "Lot, you pick where you want to go, and I'll go the other place. You look at the land, check it out. Where do you want to take your outfit and set up your business and ranching and so on? I'll go the other direction. You get the pick." Well, Lot looked at the Jordan Valley, down where Sodom and Gomorrah were, as we find out later, and that would be down by the Dead Sea. Well, down by the Dead Sea right now is rocks and sand. It's very barren. But it wasn't then. It was green as a gourd. I guess it was green as a gourd. Some gourds are yellow, you know, and other ones have multicolors, but most of them are green to one degree or another. That's where Lot went. And Abraham stayed up on the highlands, which was where Jerusalem was and Bethel was and so on. So we can tell just from that account that in the days of Abraham and Lot, the land had incredibly good grazing. That doesn't mean that you didn't have periodic droughts. That comes and goes. We know that it only a few decades later, quite a few decades, actually, in Jacob's day, they had a serious drought, 7 years drought. 7 year drought is pretty bad, especially if it is a complete drought. And because that was to bring the Israelites down where Joseph was, where God had already sent him, and he was in Egypt. So there was a divine intervention with that particular drought. But you still had a land of amazing abundance, even if you do have periodic droughts. So let's move then to Exodus chapter 3. Turn to that first of all. Exodus chapter 3. Now this is Moses at the burning bush. This is a prelude to we get up to the time of Joshua. So we're about 40 years out from this other time we're going to get into. Moses is at the burning bush, and in verse 8, God is speaking. The Lord said in verse 7, "I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. For I know their sorrows." Verse 8, "So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and bring them up from that land to a barren wasteland where there's hardly any grass growing and lots of rocks and useless dirt." Hardly. "And bring them up to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey. To the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites." And any other ites we fail to mention, don't want to be exclusive. Now, considering all the ites who were already there, it obviously had to be a land that produced a lot of food. Otherwise, you would have fewer ites of whatever persuasion. But it is a land flowing with milk and honey. That's the key phrase. In fact, that phrase, flowing with milk and honey, is used in the Bible 20 times. It is always quoting this, what God said to Moses, 20 times between Exodus and Ezekiel. A land flowing with milk and honey. And we ignore it. Yeah, flowing with milk and honey, big deal. You know, so they got a ice cream place down the way and bee's knees going around. Now, what does it mean if it's flowing with milk and honey? Where does milk come from? Milk cows, goats, and sheep. Most of us don't think about drinking, milking sheep to drink sheep's milk, but I'm glad some people do. Otherwise, you wouldn't have any Roquefort. That's a sheep's milk cheese. And there are several other really excellent cheeses that are made from sheep's milk. Goat milk, cow's milk, we're more used to the cow's milk. And we like to, you know, pasteurize it so bad that it's actually not good for us, but that's just our modern stupidity, which has probably got geographical implications in itself. So you're going to have a land that supports good populations, large populations of cows, large populations of goats, and large populations of sheep. If you're going to have a land flowing with milk and honey, it's no other way. You have to have good grassland. An abundance of it, and rainfall that you can expect in order to provide the fodder for all these ruminants. And you've got to have room for the ruminants, too. It has to be a good and large land. Ruminants means they've got four, or is it five stomachs? I forget. It means they chew their cud. So if it's flowing with milk, that's the prerequisite. If it's flowing with honey, that means bees in abundance. We have very few bees. I have never bothered with what are those bees we were reading about the other day? They don't sting you. They just flutter around and pollinate things, and they live in holes in the ground. They're not yellow jackets. They'll come out of the hole in the ground and sting you. And if that's not bad or good enough, then they'll chase you and sting you multiple times. More exciting, but these are friendly little bees. They tried to get into a chipmunk hole. It was recently vacated by a chipmunk who had met his comeuppance at one of our cats. And we were worried about him at first, so we read up on them. Now, the bees that we need for honey, because these don't produce honey, are honeybees. Abundance of honeybees. If it's going to flow with honey, the honey doesn't flow fast. That means you've got to have a lot of it. You know, it sort of builds a momentum up to flow down the plate and across the table and over the floor and things like that. Milk and honey, you have to have bees. So if you have bees, what do you have to have? You have to have flowers. Where are they going to be? Well, you got grass for the cows and the sheep and the goats, so you're going to have flowering grass. That's right. Some of the best honey is made from clover, especially sweet clover, the yellow variety, and alfalfa blossoms, which is incredibly good fodder for animals. You also have to have trees. Lots of trees, fruit trees, productive fruit trees. Fruit trees means that there's fruit being produced, which means people can eat it. If there are not enough bears, then the people will eat it. So you're going to have a land flowing with milk and honey. You've just described a land that is in a temperate climate, and super abundant, nutritious soil, and capable of all that. Good rainfall. That's biblical geography, historical geography. Now, let's go to Numbers chapter 13. Moses is still alive. The Exodus has taken place. They've actually been wandering for, I think it's about 2 years by this time. But it's time, initially, to go into the land. They didn't have to wander for 40 years. They had to because they rebelled against God. So, Numbers 13, look at verse 1. And the Lord said to Moses, send men to spy out the land of Canaan. They could have just tapped the internet and done that nowadays. But in those days, spying meant mainly scouting. Kind of surreptitious scouting, but scouting all the same. Scout out the land of Canaan. I'm giving to the children of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers you shall send a man, every one a leader among them. So he sent the men. Everyone was a leader. The two that we are particularly interested in are Joshua, who was an Ephraimite. So he was the tribe of Ephraim. He was their representative. And Caleb. Caleb was of the tribe of Judah. He was their representative. So there was a scout force that went in to check out the land. And then what he wanted them to check out, Oh, let me see. I've got the verse here, verse 18. There we go. He sent them to spy out the land in verse 17. He said, go up this way into the south and up to the mountains. So into the south, the southern end of the promised land is more or less plained with some ranges of hills, not mountains, but hills. And it would have had grazing land down there. And go up to the mountains. The mountains didn't get serious until relatively serious, until you get to Jerusalem, which is about a third to a half of the way from the bottom to the north of Israel. And then north of Jerusalem, you start getting into more and more and more mountains as you go up into Galilee. So how far did they go? To Jerusalem or up to maybe to Galilee? I suspect in the length of time that they were working, they could easily have done the circuit down through Galilee. And then they came back down, and this is what they're looking for. And see what the land is like in verse 18, whether the people who dwell in it are strong or weak, few or many, whether the land they dwell in is good or bad, whether the cities they inhabit are like camps or strongholds. A camp versus a stronghold, a walled city would be a stronghold. A city that doesn't have a wall around it is a camp. Whether the land is rich or poor, and whether there are forests or not, be of good courage, bring back some of the fruit of the land. And it was at the season of the grapes when they were sent up there. So that was the instructions. Go and do a geographical survey of the land and come back and tell us. Well, they did. Verse 23, then they came to the valley of Eshkol. Eshkol is a Hebrew word for cluster. Cluster. And there they cut down a branch with one cluster of grapes. I think they named the valley. They might have had a different name before, but they named it, I'm sure. And they carried it out between two of them on a pole. Well, I went to one of the grocery stores the other day and I looked at a cluster of grapes. And I could have carried it out on those little skewer sticks between two fingers. And I draped the grape. It wouldn't have, even little bamboo things, it wouldn't have really broken one of those. This was a pole, and these were big, strapping, tough guys, the toughest they had. And they had to carry two of them, pack one cluster of grapes back. Now, how big were the grapes? You know, you can go two ways. The cluster could just be massive with small, regular-sized grapes, or it's going to be still massive, but the grapes could have been very large, the size of plums, or maybe tennis balls. Now, I think I'll have a grape for breakfast. Nothing else, just a grape. If I'm hungry for dinner tonight, I'll have a couple. But it was a huge cluster of grapes. And they called it, because of the cluster, they named it Eshkol. And the men of Israel cut it down there and returned home, and they brought back pomegranates and other things as well, samplings of the fruit. And what it showed Moses is, wow, this is a gold mine of agricultural produce. This is a phenomenal place that God is sending us to. Just exactly what he said, a land flowing with milk and honey and lots of other stuff that go along with it. Now, what we can surmise as to what the land, the promised land, was like, based on the data that we have just gathered from these few verses, we can surmise that it was a very rich and productive land. A land that supported significant populations of multiple nations or tribes. It would be more of the size of tribes in those days, but with many cities. So it is a significant population. All the ites that we read about earlier were there. If they lived there, then they were able to live there. They had the food production processes in motion. The fruit was huge. It was a land that had grass for cattle. It has a land that had all the flowers for bees on the trees and on the grasses themselves. It was a land that had other kinds of fruit. It was a good place. That had to have soil to back up the big fruit, by the way, the right kind of soil. That was the reason why all the ites were there and all their cousins, is because it was a good land. So that tells us that at the time of the conquest of the promised land, Joshua was going in to displace people that weren't going to want to move. And they were going to need a little bit of gentle persuasion, either by Joshua and the Israelites or by God himself. And he got a little of both. So that gives us a picture of the promised land. Why was God calling it a promised land if it looked like a cardboard box? It was a land he was sending his people to. There would be a land that would be a good and large land, flowing with milk and honey, just like he said. Now, let's jump forward 400 years. This is the time of King David. Except he isn't quite, well, he is king, technically. You've got to ask, was David king after Samuel anointed him to be king? Or was he king when he took over from Saul? That's the question. He was essentially, I think, a king in waiting until God removed Saul. Because David was not going to remove Saul. He was loyal to Saul, even though Saul wasn't very loyal to him. And even though Saul wasn't being very obedient, he was loyal to what God had placed him in. And he was going to let God work out the details. David would do the work that he had to do in the meantime. Now we're going to get a snapshot. This is a snapshot of historical geography of David's day. 1 Samuel chapter 17. 1 Samuel 17. Very interesting. You can glean vast amounts of information from this kind of data that we find right here in the Bible. So here's the story. Saul's been king for a while. And to be fair, Saul was not a righteous king most of the time. Seldom. But he was sometimes a good king. He strengthened Israel against the Philistines. They were the main enemy at the time. And he defended Israel and he kind of organized it a little bit. He did some good things. Not all was good, but he did some good things. So we can appreciate that. Now, we have a big battle facing off. The Philistines and the Israelites fought again and again and again. And this was another war. The Philistines knew something about the Israelites. The Israelites knew something about them. They were facing each other about 20 to 25 miles southeast of where Jerusalem is, at the Valley of Elah. And the Philistines were on that hill over there, that ridge, and the Israelites were on this ridge. And the battlefield, it would be down in the valley. And typically, in those days of hand-to-hand combat, they would charge down in after throwing arrows at each other with their archery regiments. They would charge against each other wearing their armor and their swords and shields, and they would have it out. And in a matter of hours, the decision of the war would be made. It wouldn't be months or years or even weeks. It'd be a single day. And the Philistines were considered to be very powerful. Of course, if they were very powerful, how come they kept standing over there waiting for the Israelites to make the first move? The answer was that they were intimidated. They knew they were going to take serious casualties, even if they won. So they proposed a way to win. Let's have a champion war. We pick our champion from our forces, and you pick your champion from your forces, and they go down there in the valley, and they duke it out. And whichever one is left standing, then that side wins. And if your champion survives, we'll be your servants. If our champion survives, you'll be our servants. And the reason they wanted to do that is they didn't want to fight the Israelites. So that tells you the Israelites and the Philistines were on a par with each other. Of course, they thought they had a secret weapon. It was Goliath. You know, he might have been up to 13 feet tall, depending on the measurements and everything. Massive guy. Made it, the tallest NBA players look like little kids if he was around. Terrifying. And who was going to go against him? You know the story. David had come from his father down in Bethlehem, which is about 8 miles south of Jerusalem, south and west. And he had brought some supplies over. And he had supplies to bring. That says something about the geography of the land. And here he hears Goliath out there taunting and shouting at the Israelites, send a champion down here and we'll have it out. And calling them all kinds of names and ridiculing the God of the nation and everything. And David was furious with that. And he wanted that man's mouth shut. And his brothers told him, oh, stop talking like that. You know, what do you think you are? Some great warrior? You know, you're just a shepherd. Because that was his job. He looked after the sheep ranch for his father. I don't know what his brothers did. They obviously didn't keep the sheep. So, you know, maybe they were dirt diggers. I'm not sure exactly what their jobs were, but they were considerable men on their own right. And in David's reign over Israel, they were his trusted aides. Most of his brothers were. So David volunteered, and somebody said, well, you've got to go talk to the king. So he went to King Saul, and in verse 34 of 1 Samuel 17, Saul said, you're just a kid. You can't go out there. You're just a little young guy. You know, Saul was probably, old enough to be David's father, and probably had a big mustache and beard, looked like a Viking, more than, because Israelites look like Vikings. Lots of them did. He was a serious warrior in his own right, Saul was. And David looked scrawny compared to that. And he said, no, your servant used to keep his father's sheep, David said. When a lion and a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went after it, and I struck it, and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard, or fur, and struck it and killed it. Now your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing that he's defied the armies of the living God. And moreover, David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he'll deliver me from the hand of the Philistine. And you think, that's geography? Oh yeah, there's a treasure trove of geography here. Lions and tigers and bears. Oh, sorry, no tigers. My apologies to Dorothy. Lions and bears, large carnivores that were nuisance populations of large carnivores. That's what you'd call them when they come to eat your sheep. That's a nuisance. And so you blast them. It's like the coyotes and the sheep farmers of America today. They used to have a bumper sticker in South Dakota and Montana that said, eat lamb, 50,000 coyotes, can't be wrong. My brother raised sheep. He never went anywhere without the varmint rifle and the pickup. And if he saw any coyotes within 10 or 15 miles, he stopped and shot it. Because they get around. And he just didn't want him to get around to where his sheep were. So David didn't have a varmint rifle, and you don't use varmint rifles on bears and lions anyway. They're big. And you think, well, what do you mean bears and lions? They don't have any bears and lions in the Middle East. Oh, yes, they did. The Syrian bear, a lot like our black bear, only more ferocious. Never trust our black bears. They're not cuddly, and they're not friendly. They're dangerous as can be. But these bears were more dangerous. About the same size, but more dangerous. Lions, they did have lions. They're extinct now, but they were the Middle Eastern lion. Basically, looked just like the African lion, only they were slightly smaller. African lions will top out around 500 pounds. The Middle Eastern lions, according to estimates made, I presume, from their skeletal remains that they found, would top out around 350 pounds. And you think, oh, okay, well, it's just a 350-pound cat. That's easy. 500 pounds, I couldn't go up against it, but I can take 350-pound lion. Right. That's like taking on a jaguar down in South America, because they get up to 300 pounds. Not quite as big as these that David was going after. And David killed them with a stick and a knife, is what he had. Now, as a shepherd, he had the shepherd's staff, which was a long, slender stick, and it usually they steamed and bent a hook in the end. Reaching out, you want to check a sheep, you just reach out and hook it around the neck and then pull it over to you, and it can't run away. It's like a rope, except it's less dramatic and none of this twirly business. The other thing he carried was a rod. That was a club. So I've analyzed this. So you're going to go after the bear and you're going to go after the lion, and you've got a club. You're not going to use the staff. You're going to use the club for this. So what did he do? It has a lamb in its mouth. David had to be phenomenally fast. Everybody ran everywhere. And so he sprinted from behind it, is preoccupied with the lamb, and with his club he hits it as hard as he can on the back of the head or the neck, which will stun it, and it'll drop the lamb, which is in the record, it dropped the lamb. And then it says he grabs it by the beard or the fur, which means if you're going to grab the lion or the bear, you're going to get behind it, because it doesn't have claws behind it. It has claws that reach out in front of it. Don't get in front of the claws. and then he'll put the knife into the heart, and that will kill it. And you're like, how can you do that? Nobody's ever killed a lion with a knife. Oh, yeah, I've read the stories. One was a game ranger in South Africa. He was riding from one camp to another and doing a survey of game animals, and he had his porters coming along with the camp gear. He was out trying to locate the spot where they were going to spend the night, and it got dark on them. And so he's riding along to the tall grass with his big dogs on his horse. The lion leaps out of the grass, knocks him off his horse, and the horse takes off one way, and the dogs think he's with the horse, so they run after the horse, when in fact the lion's got him. Grabs him by the shoulder and starts dragging him off to be dinner. It wasn't the horse he was hoping for, but it, you know, humans taste like pigs, and lions don't seem to worry about eating pigs. Literally, we do. We're called long pigs, according to the cannibals. And that's the only thing that human body doesn't reject routinely. The aortas from 70-pound wiener pigs. They're very similar to human construction, and that's a good reason not to be eating pigs. Besides, God says it's unclean. He's being dragged in the night by the right shoulder. He's right-handed, but on his right hip is where the right hip over here. That's where his knife is in its sheath, because he reaches for the right hand. So he had to get his left arm around, got his left arm around, and he brought his arm up to where he could feel where the heart was beating. And as the leg went forward, he drove his knife into the heart of the lion. About two or three quick slashes, killed it, without doing him any more damage. So it is possible. So David could have done this very easily. But geographically, it tells us that you had large carnivore populations to the point that they were nuisance populations. If you have large carnivores, that number of them, you've got to have huge populations of herbivores, the grass eaters. Carnivores to keep the herbivores from taking over the world. Lions in Africa, a typical mountain lion in America will eat about one deer, like one of our white-tailed deer, one deer a week. So if you've got any significant population of mountain lions, you can tell how many deer they're harvesting through the course of the year. Because they're going to take deer. It's easier than catching little things that run too fast and dodge. They can drop on a deer and be done with it. So you have to have large populations. They didn't apparently have deer, but they had various kinds of antelope, two or three kinds, ibex and several other kinds of antelope in the land. That means if you've got large, you know, flocks of sheep and cattle and such, and large flocks or herds of herbivores, gazelles and antelope of various kinds, then you have to have a land that produces an awful lot of good grass. And forest for the cover area. You have to have a mix of forest and plains for supporting this kind of a population. So what we can draw from this is a phenomenal amount of historical data about the geography in David's day. It was a rich land. Phenomenal grazing land. And he was out there looking after it. And because it was so good, that's why the meat eaters, the carnivores, were out there. Now, with that in mind, and in getting a different picture of David's time, he wasn't a shepherd leading his sheep through a flock of rocks or through a field of rocks. He was moving them from one grazing area to another. Psalm 23. Let's look at Psalm 23 from a different perspective. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. I think I was 11 when I figured that out. That means something. Why wouldn't I want God to be my shepherd? You know, it's not the American way of saying things. When we say, I am wanting an ice cream cone, it doesn't mean that we lack an ice cream cone. It means that we want one right away. But if you are English and you say, I am wanting something, it means you don't have it. Not that you necessarily desire it, you just don't have it. It means lack, to lack. I shall not lack. He makes me to lie down in barren wastelands. No, in green pastures. He leads me beside dry stream beds called wadis in Arabic. No, he leads me beside still waters. You've got to have a well-watered land to have such an abundance of grazing grass. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness. So the paths that he leads me in are an analogy for righteousness, for his name's sake. There are dangerous areas of the paths. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you're with me. You know, you dominate this land. You are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Like David comforted his flock, taking that rod and smacking the bear and smacking the lion to the point they dropped the lamb. Hopefully didn't kill it, didn't already have it killed. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. So the enemies are the lion and the bear, and the table is here the grazing area for the sheep, using that analogy. And there are two analogies. We're the sheep, and the sheep are the sheep here. I prepare a table before me in the presence of mine enemies, an abundant table. You anoint my head with oil. You look after me. You have oil to pour on the wounds. And sheep go through grass. There are thorns and things. Periodically, they'll get a wound or hurt a hoof. And so the shepherd will use that, the staff, which is the hooked shepherd's pole, and he'll, when he sees the sheep needs something, pull it over there, and he'll pour olive oil on it. Or sometimes a mixture of a little wine and the olive oil as a disinfectant to help it heal up. You anoint my head with oil, my cup runs over. There's so much, it's running over. I'm not worried about losing water. I've got a big cup full of water, and it's sloshing out. It'd be a pity if it was coffee, but there's just water. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. Surely goodness and mercy. There's an abundance here. Those are abundance words. All the days of my life, and I'll dwell in the house of the Lord forever. So David was drawing on his shepherding to give us a view of how God looks after us. But by looking at the analogy, the shepherd side of the analogy, before we get to the spiritual side, we get another picture that corroborates with the picture of striking the lion and the bear because they were bugging his flock or flocks. And the fact that David was a very successful sheep keeper. And so his father left him with taking care of the sheep. And the other brothers did other stuff that we don't know what they did. So we have abundant natural resources, good grazing land, good grain production land. That's reflected in the story of Ruth. That was David's great-grandmother. Plenty of water with fruit and olive orchards, so you have the wine, or the oil, rather, and abundant wildlife and vineyards. Oh, that's David's day. Far less barren than Israel is, especially less barren than where David grew up, which was Bethlehem, which right now is very barren and very dry. Even though it's within sight of Jerusalem from the high points, it's a Palestinian town, and Israeli citizens don't go there. It doesn't show. It shows that they don't go there because it isn't irrigated and prospering. Now let's jump forward from David 10 centuries, 1,000 years to the time of Christ. What can we glean about what the land looked like in Galilee and in Judea and Samaria? So you had Galilee was up by the Sea of Galilee. Samaria was used to be the name of sometimes of the house of Israel, but it by then was the center section where the ruins of ancient Samaria stood. And then south of that was Judea. Those three sections of what we know as the state of Israel today. We can learn a lot from the New Testament. Number one, Jesus was a skilled carpenter, undoubtedly trained by his father Joseph, because fathers train their sons in their trade. He was a carpenter. He built things. Societies that are barely eking by in existence seldom build anything. But here you had a carpenter who built things. Peter, Andrew, James, and John, two sets of brothers, Peter, Andrew, and James, and John, were prospering fishermen. They were also apostles. Christ called them from their boats to follow him, and I will make you fishers of men, he said. They were successful fishermen, like their father Zebedee before them, in James and John's case. Matthew, who wrote the book of Matthew, was an apostle. He's also called Levi, which probably meant he was a Levite. But more ominously, he was a tax collector, looked down upon by other Jews for the most part, because tax collectors seemed to be in league with the Romans because they collected the tax for the Romans. Matthew was a tax collector. And you're like, so? What does that tell us? There were taxes to collect. If there were taxes to collect, then there had to be enough agriculture and industry to produce the income to make it worth taxing from the Romans' perspective. So the fact that an apostle of Christ was a tax collector is very notable and fits directly in with other historical research of the time and the era and the area. Look at some of the parables of Christ, some of the themes. You had Lazarus and the rich man. Yes, Lazarus was a poor man. But the rich man was a rich man. He had a lot. Now, part of the purpose of the parable was to poke at the rich man and other rich men who looked to their riches too much, which he did. That meant that there were people, for that story to have meaning, there were people who were transfixed by their wealth, which meant that there was wealth, which meant that that wealth could be taxed, and thus there were tax collectors. Huh. What about the prodigal son? This is found in Luke 15. He's a wealthy farmer. He has one son who is a no account, okay? But he has the other son who stays home and works hard. So you have multi-generations of working hard, and even the skiver, that's a English term for somebody who doesn't want to work, comes home and wants to work again. So we have productive, generational families of productive agriculture, productive farming. What about the parable of the wheat and tares? You'll find this one in Matthew 13. Remember the story of the wheat and the tares? There is a landowner who has some servants who work for him, hired men, and they come and tell him, because they're real concerned about it, hey boss, something happened while you were sleeping last night or the night before, whenever somebody went out in our field, your field, and planted, but they had a sense of ownership of it too, because they worked for him. They planted some tares, a type of weed. It looks a lot like wheat. They planted tares in your field. You want us to go out there and pull it up right now? And he said, nah, let's not worry about it. Just let it grow with the wheat. When it comes to harvest time, then we'll separate the wheat from the tares. And we'll store the wheat in my barn and throw out the tares. Why wasn't he worried about it? Why didn't he get frantic? Because he had a lot of stuff. He had big crops. Also, he had good agricultural practices. You don't go pulling things up when you're stomping around in the wheat. You're going to wreck a lot of wheat, more wheat plants than you're going to wreck of the weed plants. But he was a man that had, there was a lot of wealth there, which could be taxed, and thus there were tax collectors. There's a parable of the Good Samaritan, Luke 10. You had an abundance in the land to be able to support both Levites and priests. Remember the poor guy that got beat up and left for dead, and a Levite came by. And he saw this guy over there, and he says, I don't want to bother with him. So he goes to the other side of the road and walks on. Now, the Levite is not a priest. Now, he was of the tribe of Levi. The priests are all of the tribe of Levi, too, but they descend from Aaron. So he was a Levite, which meant that he had jobs. Sometimes they were gatekeepers, and sometimes they had all the support jobs in and around the temple, as well as around the city that surrounded the temple. When you go back and read Ezra, you'll find that all out. So he had a significant job. But in order for there to be priests and Levites who could just be wandering down the road, not off busy doing something, that meant something. They were supported by the tithes of the people. That was the tribe of Levi's inheritance. Okay, that means for there to be Levites and priests going around doing things other than their usual official duties, they must be supported very well. Indeed. I mean, you got the rich landowner that doesn't worry about the weeds in his wheat, and you got the guy that has the misbehaving son that goes off and has to slop the hogs for a while to come to his senses, and you've got the rich man, and obviously there was a lot of wealth. And then the priest came, same deal. He wasn't going to take care of him. Then came the Samaritan. The Samaritan took care of the poor guy. He dressed his wounds. He loaded him on his donkey, hauled him to the next Holiday Inn, checked him in at the desk, and said, "You guys going to look after him for me? And here's the money to cover it. And listen, if you need more, when I come back through, just keep an accounting, and I'll pay the bill." Man, what a guy! And the irony of it, the Samaritan would have looked down upon by the Jews. And you think, well, who are the Samaritans? Well, Northern House of Israel, 700 years earlier, in 720 B.C., they had been, the Israelites were all taken out of there. And then the Assyrians brought in another troublesome people from Babylon, Chaldeans. That means it was some of the tribes around Babylon. And probably were giving the Assyrians grief too. That's why they moved people around like that. It was expensive, so they only did it when you had to. Brought them and they dumped them off at the ruins of Samaria and left them there. And then they had, they right away, the poor Samaritans, transplanted Babylonians, found out that they had man-eating lions, and there is nothing that terrifies a community more than man-eating cats. I mean, even if they're leopards. I mean, leopards are scrawny. They're no bigger than a cougar. And they'll eat people, and regularly do. Have you ever heard of the man-eating leopard, or Rudra Prayag? Well, I guess not. Well, it wasn't as bad as the Tigris of Chowareth. They were man-eaters in India in the first part of the 20th century. The Tigris had 625 confirmed human kills. They figure usually it's about one, at least one more per person that never got recorded. There was one man who hunted them down. And that's just how I happen to know the story. So they had man-eating lions operating, and they asked their governors from Assyria, "Send us a priest from this land. We don't know who the god is." They were pagans. "We need to placate him so he can call the cats off." So they sent him some Levites. Ultimately, they married into the Samaritan population, so they had some small residual amount of lineage back to Moses. And Moses was a Levite too, and Aaron. So they were related distantly. That's the Samaritans. Ultimately, the Samaritans adopted and mixed their Babylon mystery religion with the knowledge of the true God that the priest of the Levites had given them. And they came to the point in John chapter 4 of thinking that they were the true descendants of Moses and the Jews were imposters. And everybody should worship at Mount Gerizim up by Samaria and not down in Jerusalem. And Christ said, "Sorry, lady, it was a woman at the well." In John chapter 4, salvation is of the Jews. However, let's talk. And then he opened her eyes to who he was, and she changed dramatically. So you have the Samaritan who was looked down upon by the Jews, who was, basically mostly Gentile, and he took care of the poor guy. And you're like, yeah, well, what's that got to do with geography? He paid his bill. And he left an open account with the innkeeper. "If you need more, I'll pay that too." So you had the ones who would typically be thought to be poor in the land, because the Jews were the dominant force in all the land at that time. You had those who would be typically poorer, who were wealthy enough to look after the unfortunates. That tells you a lot about the land, to be able to produce that kind of wealth. The wedding feast that Christ went to and other dinners he attended, he gave free lunches to 5,000 one day and 4,000 another day. The disciples were the ones that knew that was a miracle. The rest of the people didn't necessarily know. Josephus was a Jewish historian who was born in the first century and lived into the second century A.D. And he described what the land looked like in that day. As King Herod, who was not Jewish, he was Jewish by religion, but he was technically an Idumean, meaning he was of the tribe of Esau's tribe. He was descended from Esau. But he was the client king ruling the Jews. Under the Roman government, he was the local king. And they liked Judea because it was such a tax producer for the Roman Empire. So Herod was in a powerful position. Josephus then describes the land that Herod had been working on. He rebuilt Jerusalem, Herod did. He rebuilt the Temple Mount, expanded it. He rebuilt the temple phenomenally. Josephus said the sanctuary, the temple, had everything that could amaze or mind or eyes. Overlaid all about with stout plates of gold. In the first rays of the sun, it reflected so fierce a blaze of fire that those who endeavored to look at it were forced to turn away as if they looked straight at the sun. To strangers as they approached it, it seemed in the distance like a mountain covered with gold and was dazzling white. Herod made his palace, which is phenomenal there in Jerusalem, and several other country palaces. He built Caesarea Philippi, also known as Benaeus in Arab times. And the ruins, we got to tour the ruins a year and a half ago, and it was a huge city at the time. Caesarea Maritima is the one, Caesarea on the sea. He named these two places after Caesar. That helped him stay in good with the Caesar, you see. But he built a harbor on Caesarea Maritima. He brought pumice from a certain volcano in Italy and imported that. And they created concrete that set up underwater so that they would build these rafts, and then they would start filling it with this pumice, and then it would sink and mix with the water, and down under the seafloor, or down on the seafloor, it would then set up. So it became the causeway or the wall that built the harbor. And Herod orchestrated that. It takes a lot of money. He built Masada, all kinds of building projects in other countries, but especially in Israel. So that's what Josephus was describing there. He describes also the population, the whole area was, and what Israel looked like at the time, Judea and Samaria. The whole area was excellent for crops or cattle and rich in forests of every kind, so that by its adaptability, it invites even those least inclined to work on the land. Consequently, every inch has been cultivated by the inhabitants, not a corner goes to waste. It is thickly studded with towns, and thanks to the natural abundance of the innumerable villages, are so densely populated that the smallest has more than 15,000 people. That's a large, large town in those days. Still a large town. Small city, but large town. Judea and Samaria are made up of hills and plains with soil easily worked and repaying cultivation. They are well wooded and prolific in fruit, both wild and cultivated, for nowhere is the soil arid by nature, and rain is generally ample. All their streams are remarkably sweet, and lush grass is so plentiful that the milk yield of their cows is exceptionally heavy. A final proof of their outstanding productivity is the swarming populations of Judea and Samaria. That was the time of Christ and the apostles. A phenomenally rich land. Then you say, so what happened? If that's what it looked like then, and we can glean that, certainly, from the New Testament, what happened? Two wars with the Romans. First one was 66 to 70 A.D. That's when the temple was destroyed, is in 70 A.D. Had decimated, they figure that killed about 600,000 Jews. Quite a few Romans died too, but 600,000 Jews. That was a phenomenal time. The second war came later. It was in 50 years later, 132 to 135 A.D., called the Second Jewish War. It has another name. It's called the Bar Kokhba Revolt. Simon Bar Kokhba was the Jewish leader of it. Geography is affected by war. That's part of man's history. Romans destroyed Jerusalem and many other cities. In fact, they plowed fields and salted the territory of Jerusalem and had a law that kept any Jews many, many miles away. It was as close as they could get. Josephus also records that site. The countryside was like the city. It was a pitiful sight, for once there had been a lovely vista of woods and parks. There was now nothing but desert and stumps of trees. No one, not even a foreigner who had seen Judea and the glorious suburbs of the city, now set his eye on her present desolation, could have helped but sighing and groaning at so terrible a change. For every trace of beauty had been blotted out by the war, and nobody who had known it in the past coming upon it suddenly, would have recognized the place. That's what it looked like afterwards. Abundant at the time of the conquest of the Promised Land. Abundant at the time of King David. Abundant at the time of Christ and the apostles. And then after these two wars, it was a desolation. The Crusades came in 1000 A.D. to about 1200 A.D. They had destroyed what had been rebuilt, and then they rebuilt it again to some degree. However, the Ottoman, Turkish Ottoman Empire gained control of what it was then called Palestine in 1516, in the relatively modern era. During these 400 years of harsh Turkish rule, the land of Palestine was sparsely populated, mostly by nomadic peoples. By the end of the 18th century, much of the land had been owned by absentee landlords and leased to impoverished tenant farmers. It was poorly cultivated and widely neglected expanse of eroded hills, sandy deserts, and malaria marshes encroached on what had been left of agricultural land. Its ancient irrigation systems, terraces, towns, and villages had crumbled. Taxation was crippling, with its forests being taxed. The Turks taxed the standing trees. So you want to lower your taxes? Cut down the trees. Cut down the trees, you change the local climate. You turn a rich land into a barren wasteland, basically. When the people could not pay the taxes, trees were cut to fuel the steam engines carrying goods between Istanbul, Beirut, Damascus. That would have been the 1800s. The great forests of Galilee and the Carmel mountain range were denuded of trees. Swamp and desert encroached on the agricultural land. Palestine was truly poor, neglected, no man's land with no important cities. Mark Twain traveled through there in the mid-1800s, 1867, in fact. And he described it, Mark Twain, also known as Samuel Clemens, desolate country whose soil is rich enough but is given wholly to weeds, a silent, mournful expanse. We never saw a human being on the whole route, this whole section they traveled. There was hardly a tree or shrub anywhere. Even the olive and the cactus, whose are fast friends of worthless soil, had almost deserted the country. The French author Voltaire, about the same time, also traveled through there. He described Palestine as a hopeless, dreary place. The Royal Palestine Commission from Britain, when Britain got a hold of the land in 1917 is when the British took over the rule of, and governing of Palestine, because they booted the Turks out during World War I. And this is the description. The road leading from Gaza to the north is only a summer track suitable for transport by camels and carts. No orange groves, orchards, or vineyards. Houses were of mud. Schools did not exist. The western part toward the sea was almost a desert, and the villages in this area were few and thinly populated, many villages deserted by their inhabitants. That's what the Jews inherited. The Jews started, there were always some Jews there, but the Jews started to move back in the 1920s under the Zionist movement because the British now ruled it, and so they could move back there. And that's when they began to develop a population that ultimately led them to gain their independence in 1948 and to be rebuilding the country. But by reading the Bible and analyzing what it describes of the promised land, you can see why it was a promised land. You can understand the historical geography of the Bible if you read it carefully, the historical geography of the promised land by reading the Bible carefully. Times will change. It is not too bad now, but we know that based on the prophecies that are coming up at the end of the age, it will go back to what Mark Twain described. However, if you turn to Joel, we'll just conclude it with Joel. Joel chapter 2 and verse 26, speaking of those who will be living in the promised land at that time, as it will be a new promised land after Christ's return. You shall eat in plenty, verse 26 of Joel 2. Eat in plenty and be satisfied, and praise the name of the Lord your God, who has dwelt wondrously with you. And my people shall never be put to shame. And then a few verses later in chapter 3 and verse 18, chapter 3 and verse 18, and it will come to pass in that day that where the mountains shall drip with new wine, and the hills shall flow with milk. And it doesn't mean that milk will come out of the hills, it comes out of the cows, which means that there are lots of cows on the hills, and goats, and sheep. And all the brooks of Judah shall be flooded with water, and a fountain shall flow from the house of the Lord, and water the valley of acacias. It's a type of tree. It'll be a marvelous time, and that's historical geography into the future. And we study that every year at the feast. And we read those prophecies, and we can get a picture of what the land will look like from that. But when you study the history in the Bible, you can also look back in historical perspective and see what it looked like at other times. I hope this helps you appreciate how much God's Word has to offer in understanding not only the times of today and tomorrow, but also of yesterday.